is the workshop speaker meeting on the topic of mental illness and recovery. And I would like to introduce our first speaker, Luca.
Luca?
This is Luca. Lucas!
I was just reading what was on the paper, Luca.
I've been called worse.
You forgot the S.
I'm Lucas with the S. I'm an addict.
Lucas! Hell yeah, brother!
Great Jimmy Buffett once said, if we couldn't laugh, we'd all go insane. There's been a lot of laughter in this workshop. I appreciate it. Those of you that know me, I love to laugh, love to have fun. Thank God for the fellowship of NA. I wouldn't have found my way here today. Thank you, John. I was wandering around lonely in the parking garage, and I heard this voice, and we wandered around together, but we found our way. And that's, in essence, the way Narcotics Anonymous has always worked for me. I did uncomfortable things. We took the long way here. We didn't know, but we did it together. It was cold. It wasn't as cold because I had John accompanying me. We got to talk. We got to share some of our own experiences. I was like, wow, look at the program working. I've learned in this process to reach out for help. There's another member in this room. When I told her I had to speak at this convention, told me there was an IP pamphlet on it. This was Thursday afternoon. I was like, oh, shit. Because, you know, I had already did the meeting 20 times in my head. Talking to a sponsee, I didn't really know what this meeting was on. I don't know if it was mental illness in recovery, mental health in recovery, or mental health and recovery. I think those are called junctions, and it makes a world of difference sometimes. When I was asked, so is it mental illness or is it mental health? You know, was I asked because the person that asked me is in a relation with one of my sponsees, so he probably comes home and he's like, dude, my sponsor's bonkers. Yeah. Like, so is it, I'm ill or am I healthy? You know, which one? And it's humility, right? It is one of the main practices for me in my recovery that keeps me grounded and sane. To qualify. I have a home group. It's for what it's worth. Tuesdays at 6. I have a sponsor. He's probably going to kick my butt because I didn't tell him I was speaking. Shame on me. His man bun's probably wandering around here somewhere. My clean date's June 17th, 2011. I've gone through all 12 steps. When I started them, I didn't know anything. When I finished them the first time, I still didn't know anything, but I was at peace with that, if you understand what I'm saying. So, mental health, for me, this morning, I tried to live in a routine. I woke up this morning, I prayed. I meditated, I journaled, I had coffee, and I ate my oatmeal, as Wilford Brimley told me to do when I was younger. Eat your damn oatmeal. And the way I combat staying in that middle path between my illness, I mean, I don't even know if I am mentally ill. Over in Towson somewhere, there's a chart that's probably got a diagnosis. I don't know what it is. I've never asked. I meet with this guy once a month. Yeah, I don't know. I was on TikTok and Instagram last week. I came up with the diagnosis of ADHD, borderline personality disorder. I had polio for a couple days because I couldn't walk upstairs. I said, I got polio. My wife's like, you're vaccinated for that. I was like, I got COVID with the vaccine, so why can't I get polio? And yeah. In her own terms, she said, keep coming back. And I got to be careful of that, right? The amount of information that comes in my head, you know, I had ALS last year, Googling things in bed due to a pain I had. So I can get up in my head and create a lot of weird shit. Try not to cuss. So what it was like, and hopefully I get to the IP pamphlet. So like I've been weird my whole life. That used to cause a lot of shame when I was younger, right? The weird kid. Not eccentrically weird, but just the way I saw the world was just weird. And now I'm weird as an adult, and I take that as a compliment. And I think this is a meeting where I can actually talk a lot about my upbringing. I don't do that because that's where the information came in. It's where a lot of the programming. I come from a long line of Catholic Irish alcoholics, a lot of mental health issues. And I guess I got some of that too. So I grew up poor. I grew up in chaos as a single mom, middle of five kids, grew up on welfare. If you took Dundalk, shrank it down into a very one stoplight town, stuck it out in the middle of rural Carroll County, that's where I grew up, a little town called Union Bridge. And growing up, being the middle of five, I had a younger sister with severe disabilities. You know, I learned how to become very independent. But I also developed a lot of guilt and shame. You know, that I wasn't good enough because when we went to school, we went across the other side of the tracks. And there was kids that had stuff. So I always equated, you know, what I was worth to things I had. Since I was two, my mom was familiar with what the disease was. She was not an addict. But she was familiar with it, right? And so there was five of us, and she's always was like worried about me. And I was like, and I asked her when I was older, I was like, what was it about me that you were so concerned? Because I had two sisters, a younger brother, and she's like, Lucy, you were just so emotional, right? So like my emotions were so just like my responses to things. I was just, and what I didn't know through doing step work, what I learned, and I don't, you know, again, we don't diagnose people in here, we don't do this, was I was just hypersensitive to everything, right? Like I'd walk into a room and felt like everyone was staring at me. When people felt bad, I felt horrible. When I felt good, I felt great. And so I carried that with me my whole life, and I just didn't understand it. I understood it to be very weird. And so at a young age, I got in trouble, right? Was always in the principal's office, was always... And see, this is where the shame starts getting built in. I don't know. I went to school in the 80s and 90s, and they put me... And they build these desks, right? And I'd go sit, if I was in, like, in middle school, if I was in fifth grade, they'd put me in a sixth grade class with, like, these walls of shame. And I'd sit back there in the corner in class all day, which was considered in-school suspension, right? And so the shame started creeping in, that I was a bad kid, that I didn't belong with others, there's something wrong with me, you put the weird kid in the higher grade in the corner, don't look at him, right? There's barriers around him. And I internalized a lot of that. And I wasn't bad. I just couldn't sit still, right? I still struggle with sitting still. My mind constantly went, was constantly thinking weird things, right? So fast forward, first time I ever used marijuana, I fell in love. Didn't do it to be cool. Didn't do it to fit in. Friend introduced me, I thought I had found it. What it did was it turned all the volume down. Like I was all right. Like I can just finally breathe and relax in life. At 10 years old, my mom found another 12-step fellowship that deals with people like us. I remember seeing a key tag on her keychain that said one day at a time. I thought we were going to Disney World. That was not the case. What she then happened was starting getting better, and she dug into outside help and therapy. And because that worked for her, guess what she started throwing at me? So I've been in outside help therapy my whole life. I still owe our family therapist some amends. I'm sure I was horrible in there. High school was in therapy. College therapy. Late 20s therapy. Constantly in therapy. Because what I couldn't see was that maybe the disease of addiction was my main issue. So here I am trying to treat these mental health things without getting clean. And I had this moment of clarity, and there's these moments of practicing honesty along in our journey. And my mom's constantly like, you got depression. What I'm not really being honest with is my cocaine crack use, right? I don't know if you've all ever dabbled in crack. It's called crack. I like to, if I say I smoked cocaine, it makes me not sound as bad. I smoked crack, right? And I loved it. Still do. So, I don't get 13 years clean. That's my jam, dog. So if you ever smoke crack, what goes up must come down. And when you go through that down, the symptoms of depression are very similar. So I went to a doctor. Medicine, religion, psychiatry, that's my line, right? So I went to a doctor, and I got honest with him. I'm like, I'm depressed. And for once, a doctor was not going to throw medicine at me. I was like, well, tell me about it. I'm like, well, I did a bunch of crack this weekend. I said cocaine, you know, because I don't want to let them know I smoke crack, right? Our IP pamphlet talks about stigma of mental health, which is always interesting because, like, it's easy in the real world to say, oh, I struggle with whatever diagnosis I give myself that day, than to say I smoke crack. But we come in here, like, I smoke crack, and you all applaud. But sometimes it's like, I got borderline personality disorder. And you guys, oh. Sometimes y'all will. But anyway. And he said, yeah, you're depressed. You smoke crack. I said, damn. I went out of there. He didn't give me any medication. And I went on to smoke more crack. And I went on to hit a bottom. Went on to get arrested. Went on to get sent to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous via a court slip. Was the best thing that ever happened to me, because when I came in here, I could feel something. I could feel my people. I could just feel it. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it became. And I know what it is today, and I felt it. I didn't feel like the little boy who sat in the back of the class with the little barrier. I didn't feel like I was in timeout. There was people getting up, getting coffee. People couldn't sit still. All of that. I didn't stay. I went on to smoke more crack. But I heard keep coming back. What I have found in the 13 years of being clean is a solution to dealing with the insanity that occurs in my mind and how I stay teeter more towards mental health than mental illness. There is a strong correlation to the effort I put into Narcotics Anonymous versus my mental health. So when I came in, fast forward, my first 9 months in this program, I hated you. I was angry. I was jealous. I think John and I talked about somebody that had something that I didn't, and I hated it for it. I was depressed. I was anxious. And most of all, I was scared. But I wasn't willing to do the work. And I'll never forget the moment. At 9 months clean, was the last time I felt hopeless in this process. I remember dropping to my knees, and there's one word I hated when I got clean. Like, I hated. Like, we didn't read it, but the 12 steps of NA made no sense to me. And I hated it. And I hated y'all when I talked about steps, because I didn't understand how steps were going to calm this down and get all these things that I thought were problems. So at 9 months clean, I didn't want to use, but I didn't want to live. And I dropped to my knees. And I prayed, and I was hoping God would text me, email me the solution to my problem. And what came to mind was the word steps, and I had never been so angry at God in my life. I said, are you serious? And that's when I surrendered to the program of Narcotics Anonymous. Not the disease, but the program. The journey has not been easy. As I heard a speaker share at the last workshop, I went all in. I went all in with NA, and I gave it all I had. In the first, and it went great. Started accomplishing goals. My mental health seemed pretty sane. Was busy, was in service, was doing all that, was accomplishing personal things, getting kids back, blah, blah, blah. But then the mental health didn't work out so great. And where I'll get is the past 2 years in the pamphlet. Let me see if I can find it. Talks about being in a dark place. Says our work on self-acceptance is crucial, not just for our recovery, but also for our mental health. We learn to face life on its own terms. And where I had been the past year and a half was in a very dark place, because like I said, when I am grounded in this program, when I'm active in Narcotics Anonymous, my mental health is in a good spot. And so I didn't stop NA. I didn't quit NA. I just had pulled back. And through this whole process, I had another tree that stood beside me. It was my best friend. And he and I would talk, so I always had that. And then the storm hit out of nowhere. And he overdosed and died. And so, the mental health took off again. Now, I have been in outside help since I've had 6 years clean and stayed stable. So even with that help, the storm hit and I ended up in a dark place. Before he even passed away, I was not in a good place. I was irritable. I had thoughts of self-harm, suicide. You know, thank God for understanding this program. There was a moment I yelled at my kid because he had clogged the toilet for the 20th time. He's too old to be clogging toilets. My reaction was not well. Yelled at him. Took him home. I was driving back down 95. And I wanted to crash into a trailer coming the other way. I think that was the first time I realized I was headed into a dark spot. The thoughts of my self-centered impact on him, that me yelling at him was going to cause him to smoke crack and go to a doctor and do everything I did. And thought that he would be better off if I weren't his dad. So I managed to not crash into a truck. I managed to keep going down 95, take 695, exit 702, right on North Marlin Avenue, left, there's a church on the right, 6 o'clock, sheer desperation. Got very comfortable chairs. I went there and I sat in the comfortable chair, came out, got a hug from one of my sponsees, didn't talk about wanting to crash into the truck. I felt better. And it was that simple. I realized that that's my own self-centeredness, to realize that that one argument's going to impact my child that much. I realized that I matter. And I realized that if you just go to a meeting, sit in a soft chair, most of the time I will feel better. But that was the beginning of this dark place. And despite having that experience, I still struggle to go to meetings. I still struggle to call my sponsor. I still struggle to write on steps. I still struggle. I was still talking openly and honestly to my best friend, and he was in the same spot, I believe, as well. And then when he died, I felt alone. And this is how the program works with mental health. We get self-awareness through these steps. And I couldn't be around myself anymore. I hated hanging out with me. I was arguing with the wife. Wanted to yeet the dog off the deck. Cussing out everyone and everything in my head. Just was not in a good place. So I called my sponsor. And he said, very simply, he didn't say the S word. He said, you know what you got to do. I said, damn. So like when I had 9 months clean, I was in a dark spot before, and this was pointed out by others. My mom had said, Lucas with an S, I've never seen you. She calls me Booty Ma. I haven't seen you in this place since you first got clean, and I know what she was talking about. And so I called Sponce, and Sponce said, Luke, you know what you got to do. It's how he sounds, if you know. And I hit my knees, and I prayed. Again. Thanks. And I said, all right, let's see what happens. So I picked up the pen and started writing on my defects. What I learned is my defects are part of, like, the noise, the illness, the mental health, all of that go on in my head. And when they get out of control, it kind of tells me that there's something going on. So what happened over the next year, this past year, was, all right, you got to get back in service. What is the one thing you don't like doing that you did before? I know, I'll be a speaker seeker. You know why I hate being speaker seeking? Because it's like when you're in middle school and you're at the middle school dance and you go up and ask the girl to dance and they tell you no. You take it personal. It's not personal. Lucas, you need to expand your network. All the guys you got clean with, some of them are dead. You lost your best friend. How are you going to do that? Speaker seeking, speaker seeking, speaker seeking. So I became speaker seeker for my home group. Well, you're going to have to go to more meetings if you're going to speaker seek, right? Because you got to go to more meetings. Speaker seek. But here's what's really interesting with this turn of events. I, in turn, got asked to speak. And it brought me out of the comfort of my home, right? It brought me out of all the great things I've gotten in Narcotics Anonymous and what God was doing for me, what I couldn't do for myself, as long as I asked. If you are a speaker seeker in here, I'm going to ask you to plug your ears real quick. Thank you. That's all. Because if you ask me to share, I will do it. And God knew that. That is the one thing I will not say no to as long as I'm available. So God's putting these things and people in my life to improve my mental health, to bring me out of a dark spot. And thank God for the steps. We have step 10, right? It's one of my favorite steps. I do it every morning. Check yourself before you wreck yourself, right? Taking the temperature of my recovery. Taking the temperature of what's going on up here. Making sure I don't have polio. Making sure I'm not going crazy. I'll forever be grateful for Narcotics Anonymous. There's been a strong correlation of the quality of my life over these past 13 years and staying involved in this process. I'm forever grateful for the predecessors. Thank you for your hard-won experience. And with that, I'll keep coming back.
Thank you. Thank you. And our second speaker is Vaughn.
Vaughn!
Vaughn!
I'm Vaughn, and I'm an addict.
Vaughn.
I'm really nervous. I've never done this before, and I get asked to share a lot. I don't have a manila folder with notes and printouts. That's wild. I feel like I'm not as prepared as him. I have my phone, and I write a lot of notes and all the things in my calendar. So I did read the pamphlet as well. I feel like I'm not going to share the same way that he did. So let me just start off by saying that this year has been really hard. And when I got asked to share on this topic, I was like, okay, God, I think that it's really funny, but not really. Because I have spent a lot of nights in the fetal position not wanting to live this past year. And talking about it in meetings and sharing about how I don't want to wake up in the morning. Not because I don't have a beautiful life. Not because I'm not grateful for the blessings. Not because I'm not, you know, understanding of all the blessings that I have. Not because I'm not grateful for my children or that I have a home or a warm bed to sleep in at night. You know, a fridge full of food. A job that I am so grateful for, you know. Everything that I could ever want or need for my children, because I live in chronic pain every single day, and it's hard. It's so hard to wake up in the morning and not want to get out of bed because you're hurting so badly, and you just want it to stop, right? And, like, we're not doctors in here. We're not psychiatrists, we're not therapists. We all kind of just navigate off of everyone's experience, right? That's what we're looking for, is hope, experience, strength from other addicts. And that's what I've learned through the process of being clean in the last 7 years. Like, I've only gotten a house, a car, my kids back, the job. Everything that I have is because I have lived off of experience, hope, and strength. You know, based on other addicts and what they've done and how they've walked in the process, and I've walked in their footsteps, and I've raised my hand and said, like, this is what I need help with, and this is how I need to get here, and this is what I'm looking to do. Can you please help me or point me in the direction so I can get there? But, like, mental health is such a stigma, not just in our, you know, world, but in society as a whole. And, like, the way that I grew up, I was not allowed to cry, and if I did cry, my dad was such a iron fist type of man. He ruled our house with corporal punishment. He was in the Navy, and he, you know what I mean, like, that's the way that he was raised. So, like, I don't know, you know, how you guys were raised, but I feel like that generation was kind of all the same. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't know how to deal with their feelings because that's how they were raised, to kind of, like, do as you're told. And that's that. Do what I tell you to do, not, you know, what you see. And that's how I was raised. So it was, like, misinformation was just kept being passed down. And, like, I was taking a therapy because my mom left at such a young age. I was 4 when she left. My brother was 2. I've never met my real father. When I was 13, I was told that he wasn't my real dad. So, like, right off the jump, I was kind of, like, dealt these hard cards. And I didn't know who I was. So, like, I was always yearning for something. I just didn't know what it was. I really was just kind of yearning for an identity. And I didn't know what that looked like. And, I was taking a therapy, but because I lived in this Italian household where I was told, you don't take things outside of this house. You don't take your issues outside of this house. We talk about things here. You don't talk about them at school. You know what I mean? You get your ass beat. You're not taking that to school. You want them to take you? Here's the phone. Call. They'll take you, and you know what I mean? You're not going to have the nice house or car or any of the things that you have here. They're going to put you in the system, and you're not going to have shit. And that's the way that I was raised. So, you know what I mean? I just never wanted to talk about anything in therapy. The one time that CPS was called because my dad beat the shit out of us, I lied and said that nothing happened. So, like, my mental health was kind of like, I didn't really have any way to, I didn't have any way to identify, like, what was real mental health and what was just, like, already damaged feelings. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what was up, what was down. I don't know if I was just angry or sad or if I was hurting. Like, everybody always taught me when I came into the rooms that anger is just a secondary emotion to how I'm really feeling. But when I got here, I didn't really know how I was feeling. I just knew I was always angry. And I just carried that around all the time. Everybody always said that I was just angry. Why are you so mean all the time? I mean, because if you get too close to me, then you might really figure out who I am. And what if you don't like me? What if I don't like me? So, you know what I mean? Like, what I learned in this pamphlet is that if I'm of service to others and I'm of service to myself, that helps me get outside of those feelings and I can start to feel better. And, like, I start to change without my permission. And, like, what I learned by helping others and what I learned by helping myself is that helps me, like, start to build some self-love. And when I'm helping others, it helps them start to love me. What I also learned is that we're not psychiatrists, we're not doctors, we're not therapists. So, like, once the drugs are out of my system and I'm as clean as I'm going to get, then I can really start to identify, you know, what he said, what is real. Because when I'm coming down off those drugs and I have time with them out of my system, am I sad because I'm coming down? Or am I just really sad because I have chemicals in my brain that have changed over time and I need to do something about it? Because if I'm in the fetal position with 7 years clean and I want to kill myself and I got 2 kids that are depending on me, they don't deserve that because they are depending on me. They don't have fathers today. They don't have anybody but me. And I can't wake up every day wanting to kill myself. And then, you know, what happens if I really follow through with that plan? But I have people like you who teach me to talk about it. Just like when I want to get high. If I talk about it, then that plan, poof. You know what I mean? My disease doesn't have a way to lock me and load me in that. It doesn't have a way to put me in the corner. You know what I mean? It helps me back out of that corner like the pamphlet talks about. And then I can, whatever's in the dark dies in the light of exposure, right? So then I can come out of the corner and start to get help. I was off my mood stabilizer for like a month. My boyfriend could tell. He's like, there's something wrong and I can tell. And I talked to him about it and I let him know. Because like my mood definitely changed. And, like, mental health and recovery go hand in hand. It's my responsibility, just like my recovery is my responsibility. It's my responsibility to go to the doctors and take care of that because I'm a grown-ass woman. Just like I got to pay my bills. If I don't pay my car payment, what's going to happen? They're going to come get my car. If I don't take my medication, what's going to happen? I'm going to end up in the fetal position, and I'm going to want to kill myself. And if I actually follow through with that plan, they're going to come get my kids. They're not going to have anybody. And I have watched friends kill themselves around here. My baby sister killed herself when I had 3 weeks clean on Super Bowl Sunday. I carried her casket with 6 of my friends. And it was horrible. I remember when she was living in Florida and she went rogue. And she was down there in recovery and her friends called me and said that she was in a hotel with some prostitute. And she wasn't even using. She just wasn't taking her medication. She came back to Maryland. She came back in November and she was gone by February. And all my stuff was still in her room because I had nowhere to go. But I didn't use over it. Remember that? She was gone. 3 weeks out of rehab, she was gone. Her dad said that she said she was going to bed, and she never shot up by herself, and she was leaned up against the bathroom door with a needle still in her arm at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he started doing chest compressions, and she was gone. You know, my best friend Liz, God rest her soul, she told her wife that she didn't want to be here anymore, and she said, I'm not doing this with you again, because they both used for 2 years clean. She went to her home group, she came back, and she was dead in her office chair. she was only gone for 2 hours gone. You know what I mean? Like, it's taken us out left and right. So, like, if I take care of my mental health, then the disease doesn't have a way to put me in that corner. My daughter went through it a couple years ago, and, like, you know, the stigma's so real that, like, in my mind, I didn't want my daughter to take mental health medication because she was only 13, and I was worried about it. She was smoking weed. She was hiding vapes in her room. Me and my girl had so many vape pods in the bottom of her book bag. I thought she was dealing them at school. I'm so serious, man. I was like, bro, what is this? She had like 30 of them. I was like, you know, and she was smoking weed. My heart was broken. I thought that because I was taking her to NA meetings would be that, like, she was going to stay clean by osmosis. I was like, no. Like, I started crying. I'm like, what is happening to my kid? And then I, like, had to have a realization with myself and, like, a come to Jesus meeting with myself that, like, she's a teenager. You know what I mean? Like, she is going to do teenager things. But I had to also have the realization that she's her own person and I have to take care of her mental health, too. It's my responsibility. And, like, I can't be running out to meetings and going to the bowling alley and going to Denny's after meetings. Like, she has to, I have to take care of that for her. And, like, she's doing the best she's ever done. She's been on mental health medication. She's on honor roll. She has a job where she works at a daycare. You know what I mean? She's going to a trade school. She's doing the best that she's ever done because, like, I've helped her take care of that. And we go to family therapy once a month, and I'm, like, extremely proud of her. I go to therapy with her. And, like, all these things are people in these rooms that taught me that. You know what I mean? Like, I listened to other addicts who taught me that information. I listened to the experience of other addicts. I didn't base it off the opinions of other people. Opinions will kill you real fast. The experience of other people and what they went through with their families and themselves is what I listened to. And I've had 13 surgeries in 6 years, and I'm about to have two more. I'm about to have a double mastectomy in April. I'm about to have my neck fused together in 2 weeks. And that's why I've been in the fetal position multiple times in the last year. Because I'm tired of going through it. And, like, you know, the addict in me, the disease wants me to feel sorry for myself. It wants me to be in a fetal position. It doesn't want me to be happy. Because if I'm, you know, feeling sorry for myself because I'm in so much pain, then it can put me in a position where I want to use. But if I talk about it, then it can't keep me in the dark. It dies in the light of exposure. I can start to recover from it. I have planned for it. I talked to my network about it. And that's what it says in this pamphlet. When you have trusted members in your network, you have a higher power. And I'm on step 9. And I really believe that with step 8, I started to forgive myself. And that's when I really started to believe that I deserve love. I got through step 6, which I don't suggest anybody take 18 months to go through their defects, because I liked mine. Yeah, other people, like, they feel like shit. I liked mine. I was like, I think that they just helped me become, like, you know, this person that can protect herself. But, you know, other people are like, I feel like shit about myself. I'm like, you know, I just use it as a wall of armor. But other people, you know, sorry. Anyway, so and then I moved on to step 7 after I got through that. And the step 7 was one of my favorite steps. It really gave me relief from myself. And it gave me relief. I really feel like step 7 helped me surrender to the program. I know that step 1 is about surrendering to the disease of addiction and surrendering to the program. You know, step 2 helped me with all the insanity that was in my brain. And that is honestly where I started to really let the outside help work for me. And going to trauma therapy was something that I suggest every woman and man do. There's such a stigma about men talking to outside help because they want to listen to outside society and what being a man is really about and macho-ness and all this stuff. But, like, there's so much strength in being vulnerable to me. And, like, when I really learned that there's strength in being vulnerable, I let myself become vulnerable to other people, and I realized I'm not that bad. And that's where I learned in 6 and 7 that I'm, like, really a good person. I'm not as bad as I allow myself to think or let other people think. And step three, like, I really, really let go and surrender to my higher power, and I trusted another person to help me do that. Step four, if you know me, you probably know a lot about step four when it comes to my life, because I'm an open book when it comes to the things that I've done in recovery. And, you know, some of the things that I've done on the street, if you want to talk to me about it, I can talk to you after the meeting. I'm not proud of the stuff that I've done anymore. And I think that speaks a lot to the change that I've made around here. If you want to hold me hostage to the past, that's on you, not on me. Step five, again, is about humility and change for me. It's about trust for me. It's about, you know, having compassion for myself. Really building a relationship with my sponsor and letting them help me. And with outside help, again, I just know that I've learned so much from other addicts in the rooms, and I've changed a lot without my permission. Again, step six, I'm telling you, I really liked my step six. It's like weapons of mass destruction when you piss me off. But I also learned that I can't walk around like a little angry bird all the time. And I think I've gotten a lot better with it. I think I've gotten really soft in my old age, and my kids, they melt my heart. My kids are my whole world. And, step seven is really one of my favorite things. It really helped with my conscious contact with my higher power. I pray with my boyfriend every single night at dinner, when I'm in a bad mood, when he's pissing me off, when my kids are pissing me off. I just pray all the time, because, like, that's, like, really my antidote to my attitude. And the mental health part for me, like, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder very early on, and I actually don't have that. I actually have really bad PTSD, and I have really bad anxiety. And I have been on the right medication for the last couple of years. When I lost my son's father to 3 brain infections, where he'll never walk or talk again, he lives in a facility on the Eastern Shore because he was sleeping in abandominiums. It forced me to go to a doctor and get on medication because I was stuck in my house and I wouldn't leave. And I just realized that if these situations keep coming up and I end up killing myself, my kids don't have anybody. So it's up to me to take care of my mental health. And I have just learned that through other addicts around here. I feel like I'm jumping all over the place, and, you know, topics aren't always my favorite thing to do. But I feel like sharing hope is the only thing that I can do. That's all I got. That's all I got is sharing hope. That if an addict like me can stay clean, anybody can do it. This girl used to live in a tent under a bridge for 2 years. And hadn't seen her kid in 2 years. And I've lost another kid to the system. I haven't seen her in 12 years. I had another kid in active addiction, and he was taken from me as well. That kid lives with me, and so does his oldest sister, and has for the last 7 years. And they know I'm coming home tonight. They have their own rooms. And I promised them when I got them back that they would have that one day. They have food in the fridge, and they get their own food. It's annoying. I have to make, like, 3 different meals every night. And they know that I love them. I don't yell at them. I don't scream at them. I don't call them names. I don't hit them. I mean, like, I'm not judging anybody else's parenting skills, but I don't hit them because of how much I was abused when I was a kid. But I really think that's because my mental health and my recovery go hand in hand, because I take care of those things. And it wouldn't be possible. It would not be possible if this wasn't here. If people like Casey and Kara and the people that put this stuff together wasn't here, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't here. So this addict will never turn her back on the rooms, because it's never turned its back on me. But don't think for a second, I have not wanted to leave this bitch because of the fellowship. But the fellowship isn't the program. The program, the literature, my higher power, those things are the only thing that I've ever found that's perfect around here. The fellowship isn't perfect, but guess what? The fellowship the program wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the fellowship. We need it all. It all goes hand in hand. I hope that's good enough. Can I stop now? Thanks for listening.